The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Welcome back for our last week. And any thing that any of you would like to ask about what we did before, or the instructions, or your meditation, if you're meditating at home, if you have any questions about that or concerns? Or, yes, please, maybe you can wait for the mic and...
So this goes back to
It goes vertically, like straight, straight out like this. Then
oh, this way. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ah.
Yeah. So people this say that, but actually, who holds ice cream cone like this? No, it's supposed to be like up like this.
Okay. So this goes back to instructions right from the first week,
yes.
Which is. The part after the meditation session, then it said spend 1 minute or spend a minute thinking about what has happened or reviewing.
Yes.
And I just wanted to get a little more clarification about that, because what happens sometimes is thinking that, oh, I should keep note of this. I should keep note of this. This happened. And then it's after the meditation, trying to recall like the steps.
Yes.
That one went through in a little bit of detail. I mean, is that what the intention is? Or
you could do that. When I was trained in this practice in Burma by the teacher there, we were instructed to keep a notebook. And at the end of every meditation, we'd write down record, kind of like field notes of what happened that meditation. And I found that very helpful, because it wasn't like I was constantly thinking, I have to remember this, and was concerned. But there was a little extra alertness in the mind that was required so that I'd register or be present enough to remember. And that extra alertness was actually a great support for staying present, being mindful. I was less likely to wander off and things like that. And the mental faculty, in Buddhism we say that the mental faculty of mindfulness is very closely related to the mental factory of memory, of remembering. You strengthen your memory, you strengthen your capacity to be mindful. You strengthen your mindfulness, you strengthen your capacity to remember. And in fact, it's a classic instructions training in Buddhism for people like monastics being trained, that part of the training involves memorization, because it strengthens the mind, it develops the mind, it keeps the mind sharp. So this is what I was trained in Burma. Why I sometimes suggested here is that not to make people kind of preoccupied during the meditation about, I have to remember this and what's going on and how do I describe it. Keep it really simple. But at the end of the meditation, you don't have to remember it all. But just remember what you do remember. The general gist, the general idea of what happened there. So for example, you might find only by reviewing it, I spent most of that meditation thinking about my vacation plans. I spent most of my time thinking about, work and my challenges at work. And only because you reviewed it did you really realize, oh, wait a minute, it was a 20-minute meditation, and I think I easily spent 15 minutes thinking about work. I think I could have applied myself more. I think I could have stopped that. I didn't have to do that. And because you think you have that little recollection, little review, I didn't have to do that. This is what I did. Then you realize that there's maybe some complacency, maybe some giving in, some blindness going on, that maybe a little bit next time you meditate, you're a little quicker to catch that and less willing to kind of let yourself be carried away. If you don't do the review, sometimes it's like, it's over, I might as well go on with my life. And they don't realize that every time they meditate, they kind of have the same patterns going on. And they're caught in it and lost in it. And so it's a review. Also, you might review what worked. So for example, you might review that there was discomfort in the body. There was a lot of discomfort in the body this time. I was surprised. But when I sat with it, I just brought my attention to it. I had these thoughts that this is impossible. But I kept staying with it, and those thoughts went away, and after a while my body felt more comfortable. And that's what happened. And that might teach you not to believe your thoughts so much. Because many times we're in the middle of everything, moment by moment. We're living like, too much in the moment. Like, this drama is like the thing. I can't do this. This is too painful. But the review shows you that you went through a process that you could manage to get to the other end. And by remembering it sometimes, then you get some wisdom, some understanding, which will serve you the next time. Does that make some sense?
Yes.
And a very light, the remembering and reviewing is meant to be a very light touch. Just kind of think, just like sit back, have a cup of tea. what was that about? How was that? And what you want to be very careful for is you don't start judging it or spending a lot of time in analyzing, well, that was a terrible meditation, I did lousy. You don't learn from that. But you learn from, my mind drifted a lot. And, I probably could have said no to that or come back quicker.
Thank you.
So are there any questions, comments, reports?
So along those lines of, during my meditations, they're roughly 90% the same every time, right? I mean, I relax, watch what happens, and it's pretty much the same set of, I'm a planner. I mean, that's basically what it's doing, the whole plan this at work, plan that on there, plan, and, maybe it'll calm down. But, so that just repeats, and, I've been doing this about, for 6 months or whatever, yeah. And it's, so I'm getting really good at knowing that that's what I do.
Good.
It's a little tiring that, that's what meditation is, I could do that also drinking coffee, too, is plan that list. Because when I get done meditating, I'll end up writing the list.
Anyway, so might as well just start right away. It saves some time.
So, I mean, what would be, you were saying, to try and catch that earlier or not go down that path. So what would be some tools, that you would use that you would nip that or stop that or interrupt it?
Yeah.
Because I'm not using them or
great.
Don't have
Yeah. So the review, so it's good to recognize patterns like that. And so it might mean, what else could you use? Did you use the word tools? So sometimes it's useful to think of the mind as a child. And a young child, a 2 or 3 year old, sometimes needs firm boundaries. And only if you have really firm boundaries does the kid actually feel safe. And I was surprised when I had my first kid that he would be kind of doing something really, pushing the edges of appropriate behavior. And, and I'm just kind of, been trained too long in Buddhism, and so, I got to just be present and kind and accept this or whatever. And then he would just push the envelopes more, push more. And so what I learned, there were times you had to say very firmly, no, you can't do that. And then he'd look at me like I was like this mass murderer or something, like the most despicable person on the planet, and for about a second. And then he'd be happier than he was before. It's like they say sometimes children need to have firm boundaries and know where it's, so they know they're safe. So sometimes the mind's like that. We give sometimes our mind too much freedom to just kind of be crazy. So sometimes a very firm no is really helps the mind. No more planning. Be committed and kind of resolved. No more. And if it starts, no. And you have to do that repeatedly. Rather than just being mindful, you say no. So that's one approach. Another approach is that, especially if it persists, because we don't want to be in conflict with things. Like, you don't want to be in conflict with your 2-year-old. You say no, but then you don't, spend the next hour arguing it. That doesn't work either. So another approach is to start looking more deeply under the surface, in a sense, of the planning. What's fueling it? What are the emotions that seems to be kind of the fuel for the planning? And do you have any sense of what that is for you?
I mean, there's, some fears in there or, fears in terms of not getting things done that I had committed to get done. Uh-huh. Or
So that's great.
Or forgetting, which would be the same thing. Like I had told myself I was going to do something, but if I don't remind myself, I'll forget.
This is great.
Keep reminding myself.
So you said two things, two general categories of things.
Right.
You said there was fear, and then there was a story connected to the fear, the imagination of what would happen and stuff, right?
Right.
So you could do one of two things. You can give more attention to the story, or you can put the story aside, just words, and focus on what's actually more immediate, which is the feeling of fear. And that's what we try to do in this practice, is to put aside the story. And maybe it's true, maybe it's not true. That's for a later, another time. And one approach that meditators will take is to shell the stories. You know, this story, this concern might be a real concern, this plan is maybe necessary later. And a really clear sense, I'm going to do this later, sometimes helps the mind relax. Okay, the mind knows later it's going to be, we're going to get be taken care of, but now that now is not the time. And so then, rather, what's more intimate or immediate is the fear. And if can you bring your careful attention, mindful attention, just to feel the fear and be with the fear, and let the story be for later. And perhaps the story, the concern you have, maybe it's a real concern, but it doesn't have to be coupled to fear. It can be a practical concern that you said you're going to do something and figure out how to take care of it, or make amends or something. But you can approach those concerns without being afraid. So what we try to encourage people to do is to separate out the story and just stay with the fear and see if you can settle that. And then you're going to be in a much better place to plan. Chances are you don't plan very well when you're afraid. And also then you're freer maybe to pick up planning. So that's why there's the mindfulness of emotions we talked about the third week. Is a really big, important part of being able to deal with this kind of planning mind, because under the planning mind, for the most part, are these emotions. Does that make some sense? And the authority of the stories is quite something, and so that you know, there's such a strong sense of authority. I gotta work out the story, and if the solution was in working out the story, none of us would have problems. Given the amount of time people spend trying to think things out. I mean, sometimes it's useful to think things out, but, you know, the repetitive nature of kind of reviewing and planning is that, you know, the track record is not very, the success rate is not great. So there must be another approach. Someone else? Yes, please. Maybe pass the mic. Thank you.
Okay, well, trying to meditate on thoughts, very challenging. Sometimes I can sort of reserve a little corner of my mind to sort of be a observer of the thought, but it's, 90-95% of the time I just get captured by the thought and carried away. Any suggestions as to how to maintain a little bit more space there?
So what percentage of the time do you... How in a 20-minute meditation, how much of the time are you lost in thought, and how much of the time you feel like you have some presence, some awareness of what's going on?
Probably about 50-50.
So I would say that's very good. So there's other 50%, your mind wanders off and you're gone, whatever. So I would try to strengthen the 50% that is there. Try to give a little bit more emphasis to it, appreciate it. So it becomes stronger and more of a second nature to go there, because one of the fascinating things about being lost in thought—if you're really good and lost in thought—you don't have a problem, because you're not present enough to know you have a problem. So you know, not here, not a problem, right? But if you're present enough to know that you're wandering off in thought, then that you don't have a problem either, because then you're present. You know what's going on. What some people do is they know they're drifting in thought and they judge themselves, oh, I'm bad, I shouldn't be doing this. But if you have the presence of mind to criticize yourself for your practice, you have all the mindfulness you need to continue the practice. You just wasted your time by criticizing yourself for not having enough mindfulness. You do, in order to, you know, does it make some sense? So I would just strengthen those 50% that is working. And then what you can do very gently is when you are present, sit up a little bit straighter, a little bit stronger, firmer, like you're a posture of resolve. And say, I'm going to be resolved to try better to stay present and not wander off in thought, or to be present and catch myself as I begin wandering off. And sometimes bringing a sense of resolve and strength to the practice, not straining, not contracting, but some resolve and strength can help kind of... improve the percentages for you.
Yeah, the other there's also a part of time where you know, you're basically present, but there's sort of a little whispering, ongoing commentary that, yes. that doesn't break threshold, but it's sort of there, and you're just sort of, well, I wish you'd go away, but you're quiet enough so I can just sort of let you be there.
Yeah, just let it be in the background. Just ignore it. Let it fall away. at some point, if you get more concentrated and still, then you might turn around and look at that because it's not so much. If the threshold you said, if the thinking is much softer than the rest of the mind, just let it be there. But as the mind gets quieter and quieter, the thinking might not change, but it becomes no longer under the threshold but above, and then you bring your attention to do it through mindfulness of thinking. But I'll often just ignore small, kind of, you know, background thinking that doesn't seem to be getting in the way. Yes, please.
Is mindfulness
it's green light.
Is mindfulness do we choose to be mindful, or do we allow the noticing to happen?
It's generally people who choose to be mindful generally are the ones who become more mindful, who develop that capacity. Those who allow mindfulness to happen sometimes have to wait a long time. And if you allow mindfulness to happen, there's a lot of wisdom to letting that happen, but do you choose to allow it? How do you get around choice?
So how much choosing do we do? So for example, when I notice and notice and notice, I think, oh, if there's a thought, a sensation with a thought, the mind is this. At any moment, there seems to be many choices of mindfulness.
Right.
Which, how much do I choose and how much do I relax into the noticing?
Can you do both? And I think that's it's not either or. And there are different factors that are coming into balance all the time. So like right foot and left foot are operating both. So learning to relax and soften and open and allow awareness to arise, it's a very important quality, because if we don't have that, then there can be too much ego involved, much striving, needing, expectation. A lot of things can go on if you don't have that relaxing and allowing. But if you only allow and relax, sometimes the mind can drift off a lot and there's no strength and stability in it. And so sometimes you need to actually apply yourself. If the mind is really out of control, sometimes you have to apply yourself a lot and really use that choice, and it's much more directive. And so where that balance is between allowing and directing, being present, applying oneself and relaxing and opening up, that's going to vary all the time depending on the local, you know, what's going on with the inner weather and all the different, there's so many factors, like an ecology in there. So it's all these different animals and plants and everything going on there, and the balance is constantly shifting and changing. And so part of mindfulness practice is starting to become aware of the inner landscape and see what's needed. So, for example, if your mind is really racing and really spinning out because you're afraid you're going to give a big speech to someone, and you say, God, boy, I'm just like spinning out. I can't even read my notes for this important speech. I can't just allow myself to be relaxed and open. I'm just going to be taken over by my nervousness. And so maybe what's needed then is the real firm counting the breath. Just applying, I'm going to stay with the breath. I'm going to hold on to the breath at all costs until the breath calms me down. And once a person's calmed down and very present, then it might be the time to open up and just allow awareness to arise. Because one of the beautiful things that can happen in life or meditation practice is when the mind, thinking mind, doesn't have the upper hand, it's possible to just not even try to be mindful, but just kind of let the curtains have been pulled, and you naturally see what's outside the window, or the night sky. If the clouds are no longer there, you naturally kind of look up and you see the stars. But when the clouds are there, it's, you know, you have to blow them away or do something. So so sometimes if the mind is no longer agitated and caught up in its concerns, it's very much, all a person needs to do is just relax, and then there's a natural mindfulness that arises. And so that figuring out where you are on that range is part of, you know, as people mature in this practice, is tracking that and being able to be wise about, you know, how much, what kind of effort do I need to make? Is it that firm no, or is it investigation into the emotions underneath something, or is it just relaxing and just feeling it and being with it and not being bothered, but just feeling it and not investigating, not saying no, but just being in a relaxed, open way? So there's a whole variety of ways, choices in mindfulness. It can be a lot to say this in intro class, like, oh, no, I have to be busy and think all these choices. But it's kind of like learning to ride a bicycle. When you ride a bicycle, there's a lot of choices to make. Sometimes we just let go and relax and don't pedal and just kind of let the coast down the hill. Sometimes we see a big hill up ahead and we know we have to speed up to get some momentum going. And then you have to gear down and really stand up in your seat and kind of pedal hard to get up the hill. And then you see you're going downhill and there's a a curve up ahead with a gravel in it. And you know, that's bad news for a bicycle. So you have to slow down a lot and be really careful. But with bicycle riding, if you learn how to do it, it becomes second nature. All the different ways of energy, all the way in which you apply yourself. Sometimes you let go, sometimes you work hard, sometimes you just kind of coast along at a steady pace. It becomes second nature. It's kind of simple after a while. You don't have to think about it. So the same thing with meditation. If you do it a lot, if you do it every day at a regular basis, over time you get familiar with the terrain. You get familiar with the pedals and everything that's involved. And then it becomes kind of second nature what kind of effort to make at different times. And I'm a little bit, you know, I apologize if I say this, if I'm saying something inappropriate to you, but you told me you come from a Zen background. And sometimes there are schools, especially like some Zen and various other places, who have sometimes a singular idea, this is what meditation is, only one thing, and you can't do anything else but this one thing. And so like you have to, you know, and so it's, you know, it's like one tool supposed to fit everything. There's something really wise and profound about that approach. But what people don't learn then is how to navigate the different terrains your bicycle can go on. It's not always going to be on the highway. Make some sense? So, with that, maybe it's a nice segue into what I was going to do next. So the first thing I want to say is that mindfulness practice, mindfulness meditation, is using a very simple, ordinary capacity of the mind to notice what's happening as it's happening. That's the bottom line, just simply noticing. And don't have to make it more complicated than that. And one of the little aphorisms we have is that if it's not simple, it's not mindfulness. So if you're starting to negotiate, engineer, analyze, try to remember all the different things Gil said, and then you've lost it. Just relax. And just notice what's going on. That's the bottom line. And on top of that, there's a variety of things you can do and add on top of it. But the idea is to keep it simple. And so it's a capacity to notice what's happening as it's happening. And primarily when we meditate, we give primary attention to the breathing because the breathing is calming, it helps focus, and it helps develop mindfulness. So it's a useful place. But if something else happens that's more predominant than the breath, makes it more difficult, more compelling than your breathing, then it's fine to let go of the breath and turn your attention to notice that compelling thing. So if it's strong sensations in your body, then you bring this meditative awareness to those sensations in your body. If it's loud sounds outside, you bring a meditative awareness to the sounds outside. If it's strong emotions are coming up, that's what's grabbing your attention, then you bring a meditative awareness to the emotions. If it's a lot of thinking going on, you bring a meditative awareness to that. And what a meditative awareness is a non-reactive, non-judgmental, full attention, recognizing what it is, and calmly, calm, as best as calm as you can, bring your attention to register, to recognize that, oh, this is what's happening now. And then as you recognize this is what's happening, feel it, sense it, feel the texture of it, just kind of be, what, this is how it is. So if you're hearing sounds, just let yourself recognize their sounds, and then really feel, be present for the experience of listening. That's all you need to do. And then when something's no longer compelling, you come back to your breathing. And so as you do this, what you're cultivating is an ability to bring more heightened sensitivity and awareness to these different aspects of our lives. And then in daily life, you'll have this ability also, if you, it'll help you be in your present moment, with the present moment experience, and start noticing what's compelling, what's the predominant, what's been activated for you in the present moment. Is what's activated for you, is it, that your body is speaking and wanting something, your emotions are activated, your thoughts are really activated. What is it going on for you in the present moment? And what needs your attention? What's a useful way to be here with the situation that you're in? So it's a simple noticing of the experience, recognizing that as you notice, there's different areas you'll notice. And so you tend to notice whatever is happening that's predominant. There are two different general ways of understanding these instructions. One is called prescriptive, which is that this is what you do. So, so the prescription is to bring your attention to the breath. And then if there's a loud sound, bring your attention to the sound. If there's a strong emotion, bring your attention and really focus on the emotion. The other way of doing the practice is not prescriptive, but rather descriptive. And this is, rather than this, what I'm saying being being things you're supposed to do, it describes what you'll notice if your attention is open. So if you're mindfully and open to the present moment as it presents itself, you'll probably start noticing whatever it is that's most compelling at the moment. And you'll notice sometimes your breathing. Because if you're sitting still, the biggest activity going on is breathing usually. So, at some point you start noticing the body's breathing. If you're relaxed and open, you start noticing your sounds will come. You'll notice as a sound has come. So the difference between these two modes, a little bit, is that the prescriptive, it's more like you're bringing yourself to the experience. The descriptive is more like the experience is coming to you. Make some sense? If the mind is really busy and scattered, then usually you have to bring yourself to your experience. And so you keep coming back to the breath, coming back to the breath, being with the breath. But once you get in the groove with the breath, you can stay with the breath, it becomes easy to stay with the breath, you're relaxed and settled around it, then you don't have to do anything anymore. And then the meditation proceeds better the less you do and the more that you allow, like Julie said earlier. So then at that point, you just kind of relax and allow the breath to come to you. You might still have to make some little bit of effort, but it's not the effort to bring yourself to the breath, it's the effort to stay open to the breath. Does this make some sense? So again, it's a little bit like I said earlier, that depending on what's happening in your inner life, your mental life, the practice changes its nature. And so sometimes it's more applied, and sometimes it's more active, and sometimes it's more receptive. And so you can experiment with the active and the receptive mode. And on different days, at different times in the sitting, one is more useful or more nourishing than the other. So the image that Buddhism has, I add an element to it. Buddhism has a symbolic way sometimes of representing the human person in the form of a one-room house. And so this one-room house has five windows and a door. This corresponds to what in Buddhism says is the six senses. So it's the five senses that we usually refer to. So sight, smell, taste, hearing, and touch. Plus, what the Buddhism has a sixth sense, which is that inner perception that knows what you're thinking and what you're feeling from the inside. So those are we're like a one-room house with these five windows and one door. And the prescriptive mode of doing meditation is more like there's an easy chair in the middle of the floor in this one-room house. And you sit there in your easy chair, relaxed and at ease, And you notice what arrives in the door or in the window. A cat wanders across the doorstep, and you just watch and see the cat go across. And you just really relax and you just notice it there. You don't get up out of your chair and chase the cat. A bird lands on the windowsill. You just watch and just notice there's a bird there. You don't try to chase the bird away or something. You just notice the bird. So all kinds of things will come and go through the windows and the doors, but you don't leave the easy chair. You stay there and just notice, oh, this is what's going on now. This is what's going on now. This is what's happening now. And you don't close the door if you don't like what's out there. You don't go chase it if you like it or something. You stay in your chair, let it be what it is out there, and just notice what's happening. The difference is that I think it's a nice image for meditation, except for the if you take the easy chair too literally. Because if you kind of find yourself in really soft, cushy, easy chair to sit back in when you meditate, your meditation probably won't be very alert. And so it's good to sit up straight. But when you sit up straight, maybe you can kind of internally imagine that you're cozy, you're safe, and that you're just going to be present for your experience as it is. Make some sense? Please.
I don't know if you mentioned this or I missed it. You said there are six senses, and then you only mentioned five.
Did I?
So I'm not sure.
Yeah, it could be. It's hard for me to remember everything. So, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, and touching are the five. And then the sixth one is the perception allows us to be aware of our thoughts and our feelings in the mind. And Buddhism claims that's a sense that puts in the same category as what we, in English, say the five senses.
And that would be the door, or
probably
or the chair?
Door, because it's bigger and more important, and a lot more goes in and out.
Okay, it's like self-awareness.
What?
Like self-awareness?
Also, self-awareness happens in that inner perception. Yes. Okay. So I thought we would do a meditation, and we're now sitting for half an hour or so. If you want to stand and stretch, so to get yourself kind of stretch, shake out. If you're sleepy, stretch a lot. So in this meditation, it's going to be a guided meditation, and I will start with giving you instructions on more of the prescriptive mode of mindfulness, where you apply yourself and direct your attention. And then at some point I'll switch the instructions so it's more descriptive side of it, where you just stay open and allow yourself to notice what comes to you in the present moment. So, sitting upright in an alert but comfortable posture. If you're sleepy, the alert becomes really important. Gently close your eyes. And then take a few long, slow, deep breaths as a way of settling in. Connecting, feeling your rib cage expand and stretch as you breathe in, and then allowing your whole torso to settle and relax as you breathe out. Breathing in, breathing out. And then let your breathing return to normal. And scan through your body to see if there's any obvious places of holding or tension that maybe it's, you can soften a bit. So perhaps you can soften around your face and your eyes. Especially as you exhale, it can be a releasing, a letting go of tension in your face. Softening around the shoulders and shoulder blades, perhaps as you exhale, softening, releasing to the gravity. And it can be useful to soften the belly, let the stomach hang forward. And then bring your attention to the part of the body breathing where it's most compelling to experience the breathing, where the strongest movements are or where it's most sensations around breathing. And let your attention settle in or focus itself on the area where you feel you're breathing the most in order to feel the rhythm of in and out, rising and falling. To notice what's happening. See if you can let go of your thoughts so that you can better direct your attention to experience the body breathing. Feeling your breathing, noticing how the inhalation is experienced differently than the exhalation. And then, in a calm way, relaxed, open, non-reactive way, as if everything is okay, bring your attention to the strongest sensation in your body. And if that sensation is the body breathing, stay there. But gently bring your attention as if it's completely okay for that sensation to be there. Your job is just to be present for it, to feel it, explore it, get to know it better in a calm, non-reactive way. If it fades away, then you can find the next strongest sensation. And then bring your attention now calmly and non-reactively to whatever your emotional state is, whatever way you're feeling, mental state, mood, whether it's subtle or big. Calmly let yourself know how you are, how you're feeling, as if it's completely okay to be this way. Recognizing it. Making space for yourself to be this way, just space and awareness. And then now, calmly, notice if you're thinking. Non-reactive, open awareness. Just to recognize if thinking is happening. Nothing to let go of. Nothing to do, but just recognize it and see it clearly. Thinking. And then notice whether deep inside of you, in the muscle that thinks, in the heart that feels, see if you can notice if there's any place of holding or pushing or wanting that you can relax. Any place of resistance or impatience that you can let go of. Allowing yourself to settle in deeply into yourself as if you're settling into an easy chair. Here. Safe, content, present. The place deep inside where maybe there's contentment or ease or sense of peace or hints of it. Place of home, and in your one room home there's an easy chair that you sit in. No need to go out and do anything, but in whatever door, whatever window something appears, let it be known. Breath, body sensations, sounds, feelings, thoughts. Let it be known without getting caught by it, without getting involved with anything. Let a thought be just a thought, so that you don't get involved in thinking about it. Letting go of your thoughts enough so that you can sit back and calmly know what's going on without being caught up in what's going on, reactive to what's going on. As if whatever is going on at the windows and the doors has nothing to do with you. It's just phenomena that occurs. If you wander off too much in thought, then you might direct your attention to the breathing. Apply yourself to the breath, one breath after the other. A kind of committed relationship between you and breathing. Will you commit yourself, just stay with your breath, one breath at a time. But if you're not wandering off in thought a lot, and you're pretty much present, maybe just stay open, stay in your easy chair, and let the parade of phenomena, of experience, show itself. We'll just spend a little bit more time, a minute or two. But see if you can settle back into only recognizing what's happening, whatever is happening, as if what's happening is okay, as long as you're mindful of it. Nothing to resist, nothing to complain about. Just what's happening, to see it, to be aware of it, as it is. And then to end this sitting, you can take a few long, slow, deep breaths. Feeling your body, and when you're ready, you can open your eyes. So, keeping it simple has a lot of potential, a lot of power, because often in our life we don't keep things simple. We don't let things just be as they are, but we'll judge them, we'll criticize them, we want them, we'll push them away, we hold on too tight to them, We analyze them, we make stories about them, endless commentaries about them. There's a lot that we do. And so it's actually can almost like pull the rug underneath a lot of our ideations when we just leave things be simple as they are. And it can be quite a challenge to do that. But as we learn to be mindful of just this moment's experience and the simplicity of this moment, we're uncomfortable, so then we just be mindful of discomfort. Nothing more complicated than that. Just this is discomfort, and the task is to be present for it, as if it's okay to be uncomfortable. That's a pretty radical thing, and compared to how most people's minds work, where if you're uncomfortable, you have to do something. Something has to change, and someone has to do something to fix it. But here, just okay, I'm uncomfortable. I'm going to be open and be present in a mindful way for this discomfort. Or if it's really pleasant, to be present just for that, in a simple way. So there's a lot of wisdom that can be learned or had from keeping things really simple, and a lot of freedom from that wisdom, because it's such a contrast to how we make things simple. So I want to show an example of keeping things simple and making things more complicated than they need to be. Okay, so I want to show you something so you can see it. It's kind of small. So can you see this flower here? So so it's a flower, just a flower in and of itself. Nice flower. Some of you are already having commentary. What's he doing with the flower, and what's he going to do with this? And it must be something profound or... But anyway, just a flower, and sometimes they call it the thusness, the suchness of the flower, just a flower. So, but then I can do something interesting. I can take another flower. Now, can you see this flower here? It's really small, right? Can you kind of see the little purple flower? So now we can say something different than we couldn't say before. Now we can say that this is the big flower, and this is the small flower. Right? You see that? Those of you can see the small one, purple one, right? This is small, this is big. You see my left hand? The big one is my left hand. Okay? Now you can watch how this magic works. You can see how it works, okay? Big, small. Now which one's big? Now the right is big, and the left one is a small, but this left hand, the flower on my left hand didn't leave, right? It's still the same flower. And now we say it's a small flower. Small and big does not live in the flower. It lives in the comparison that we make. It's not inherent in the flower. The suchness of the flower is independent of how it is in comparison to other things. To be aware of, to be mindful of the suchness of our experience is to allow it just to be as it is. A lot of human suffering comes about because of comparative thinking. And we don't allow things just to be as they are. We compare it to something. Sometimes it's okay to compare. It's not always a bad thing. But a lot of suffering can arise from that. So, a lot of ideas which people have about... A lot of ways that people suffer around their self-concept. And I think most people have some suffering around their self-concept, self-image or something. You're too tall, you're too short, the hair's too this, too that, not enough hair. This part of the body is too little, too big, too small, it's all these things. But our body is just, in and of itself, the suchness of it is quite happy. It's not an issue. What's the issue is the comparison we make. When I was 13, this is long, long ago, 1967, I lived in Italy, and in Italy, I was one of the. I knew I was the coolest kid in this little town we lived in, because I was the only boy with long hair, and blue jeans. So that was like cutting edge stuff back then, and my hair wasn't that long, but it was for 67 it was long, and I was kind of had a certain pride around my. Being cool, as a 13-year-old might be. And that went very well for me that summer of 67 in Italy. But then I came back to California in the fall, and a lot had happened in California in the summer of 67. And and I came back to school, and my schoolmates, they had let their hair grow a lot longer. And they had discovered that you could not only wear blue jeans, but you could do these things to blue jeans. You could wash them 10 times and get them bleached. You could tear them. I had friends who put their blue jeans on the road so cars would drive over them. And now you have to go to the store and pay for this kind of thing. But back then, you know, they knew the secret. You just put them on the road and people drive over them. And I just had blue jeans, and I would sit in class, pull my hair, trying to make it longer. And I kind of felt deflated because I wasn't that cool anymore. And the only thing that had changed was I'd crossed from one country to a different country where the reference point was different. And so my inner sense of well-being had a lot to do with who I was comparing myself to. In mindfulness, you don't have to compare yourself to anybody. What's the experience of yourself in your own suchness, just as you are, the simplicity of your being? Can you put aside all the comparative thinking? It's hard to do because we're kind of addicted to it sometimes. And so much of our self-concept is so deeply kind of tied up in having made these comparisons, these ideas of, and then there's ideas what we should and shouldn't do that we compare ourselves to, and many things. So what mindfulness can teach us to do is to move towards more and more simplicity, where we don't add a lot. So it's not just simply that we're learning to relax by being simple and just being present for things as they are, but it gives us a vantage point, a perspective, that helps us to see and notice when we start adding this extra stuff on top of it. And that's where the wisdom comes in. Because it's such, I'm sitting here quite content. I was able to follow 3 breaths, that's good. Then I lost it, I came back. I followed 3 more, that was good, that's nice. And then I wonder if the person next to me is following 4 or 5 breaths, more breaths than I. I bet that person's, I can never succeed. I try things and I'm not really good at it. And then we get caught up in that comparative world. But just being with 3 breaths and wandering away, coming back, wandering away, having 3 breaths and wandering away, the suchness of that experience is very simple. There's no need to compare it to anything. So to have a sense of the suchness of something, the simplicity of the experience in and of itself, can show us when we make it more complicated than it needs to be. And if you can see how that works and put a question mark behind it, then you become much more autonomous, much more, you develop inner strength, you develop capacity of wisdom, don't get fooled as easily. You have kind of a natural autonomy from all these ideas and concepts we get caught up in. Does it make sense? So part of the function of this mindfulness practice is to cultivate wisdom. And part of the wisdom is not to be caught up in self-concepts and self-comparisons that make up so much stress that many people live under. And then as we do that, then we can see better when we start doing it. And if we see when we do it, we can maybe change our relationship to that, not believe it, not get involved with it, let it be like that. So this is one example of the variety of ways in which the mindfulness practice then opens up to wisdom. And one of the functions of mindfulness practice is to open up to wisdom so we become wiser people, more understanding people. We go through our lives in a wiser, more understanding way. So mindfulness practice is not only about being present for experience, learning to be present in a non-reactive way. It's very useful to do that. But if that's all it was, it has some value, but then we're not really growing and developing in all the ways we can. And part of the function of this mindfulness practice is to facilitate the growth of wisdom and understanding what's going on. So this is part of it as we go along. So just kind of give you some sense of what's possible. So what I've emphasized so far in these 5 weeks is that mindfulness is, mindfulness in meditation is a meditation practice. But it's also something that can be applied in daily life. And some of the exercises in the handouts were about practicing in daily life. One of the very important moments for me in my early meditation period practice was the time when I realized that my mind in meditation was the same mind as outside meditation. And in meditation, I was discovering this deep sense of well-being, some sense of calm and integrity that I really valued. And at some point, I wondered, well, why don't I want to have that in my daily life as well? It's the same mind. And so at that point, I became interested in how to bring what I was experiencing in meditation, which for me was a certain level of calm, but the most important quality that I really valued was a sense of integrity. The meditation, the stillness, the simplicity of it, I felt a lot of integrity. I said, why shouldn't I have this integrity in my daily life as well? And so then my task became how to bring this mindfulness, how to bring this practice into my daily life so I can stay close to that place of integrity. And so one of the opportunities you have is to take some of the basic principles and ideas of mindfulness from meditation and start applying it to your daily life. It doesn't mean that, you know, you have some busy job and you're supposed to suddenly get really quiet and mellow. And I had a friend of mine worked at a big kind of store. He was kind of a manager type. He'd been a Zen priest. And because he'd been a Zen priest, he sometimes would hire former Zen students to come and work, and until he realized it didn't work so well to hire some of these Zen students, because they like to do things really slow and present, and they were like in a warehouse packing things to mail, and you couldn't do it. You know, that wasn't what the job was called for. It was called for doing things quickly. So, you know, mindfulness in daily life doesn't necessarily mean do things slowly. I learned this when I went from the monastery where we could do things slowly to working at Green's Restaurant, which was the restaurant Zen Center owned, I was a fast order cook. And I had to do like 5, 6, 7 dishes all at once. And it was just great. I loved it. I would leave the restaurant calmer than when I came in, not because I was calm and relaxed, everything, you know, but because I used my practice of mindfulness to give myself completely over to just doing what I had to do in the kitchen and not worrying about the future or thinking about what I want to do the weekend or, you know, thinking about my relationship to the other people. What are they thinking about me? Do they like me? And I just kind of gave myself to just cooking 7 dishes at once and spinning around the kitchen. And I was fully there for it. So anyway, the point being that mindfulness in daily life doesn't mean that you have to do things slowly. So sometimes it's very nice. And so what's nice to do is to begin looking for opportunities in daily life to bring this heightened awareness of what's happening in the present moment. So it can be as simple as when the telephone rings. There's sometimes a tendency in people to rush to as if something dire is going to happen if you don't get it at the first ring or the second ring. But most people don't hang up after even 3 or 4 or 5 rings. Maybe they used to not hang up for 9 rings, but maybe life is going faster now. But you can at least let it go for a few rings. And the opportunity there as it's ringing is to check in with yourself. How am I? What's going on for me? What am I thinking? What am I feeling? What's happening? Because a person can go through their daily life quite actively involved in things and not really knowing how they're feeling, what's going on for them. And so to take that as a mindfulness cue to stop and notice. And then when you answer the phone, you're more in touch with yourself. Maybe it's more useful to do that. I learned this a little bit when I was at the Zen Center, where at the Zen Center, when you walked into the meditation hall, it was you had to always walk into the meditation hall with a particular foot first. And you had to be mindful and aware which foot it had to be. You couldn't just walk through the door as if you were just walking through a door and not think about it. You had to always know which foot you had, which foot was where, and what, so you had to be certain presence. So after I was at Zen Center for a while, I applied that to the rest of my life. Whenever I walked through a door frame, which was kind of going from one space to another, I used that not necessarily to look at my feet and which foot had to go across, but to take stock and say, well, what's going on now? Be mindful, be present for what's happening and for the situation I'm walking into, for how I am. And I found that taking a few moments like that to check in with myself was really beneficial. Heightened my awareness myself. I became wiser about myself. I knew where I was at, became more grounded. And also then I paid attention to the situation around me a teeny bit more. Rather than for me, it was just really useful because I have a great capacity to spend a lot of time thinking. at the expense of noting. You know, have you ever? I hope it's never happened to you, but maybe I shouldn't tell you it's happened to me. I'm happily driving down the freeway until I realize I passed my exit because I was quite happy. It actually happened just Tuesday, but that was because I was having a lively conversation with my passenger, and I said, "Oh, I think we passed my exit." But it can happen alone, right? So anyway, I found that this like door frame thing is a useful kind of cue, reminder, pay attention. And I've known people who put little stickers on every light switch in their home. So that every time that they flip a switch, they see that little sticker, and it reminds them, how is it now for you? What's this moment like? Rather than doing it casually, instrumentally, as if, get this over with, like do the real thing. She says, what's happening now? So some people like to have these cues, these ideas. Some people like to take particular activities and bring mindfulness to that activity as if you're doing meditation practice. So like washing the dishes, if you wash dishes in the sink, for example, to not do the dishes as a way to get over them as quickly as you can, but rather to do them as a meditation, meaning that you're going to be fully there for the dishes, and then if the mind wanders off, you come back to the dishes. If strong feelings come up, stay with the feelings and notice them and then go back to the dishes. Just stay in the present moment with the dishes the same way you would with the meditation. It might take longer to do your dishes, but what happens then is you're developing a habit or familiarity what it's like to stay present as you wash the dishes. With time, you can do dishes faster, but you're there and you know you're present there rather than not present, thinking about something else. You might think that you have other things that are important to do, and maybe you do, other things that are important to think about and plan. But to live a life of planning, to live a life of thinking someplace else, is to live a life that's a little bit disconnected. And there's kind of a richness in life that happens when we can just be there for the simplicity of the moment for what we're doing. And as we stay there in the simplicity of the moment, that's where much more profound wisdom is available. We can see much more clearly what's going on in our life in a way we can't if we're thinking about something else. So it takes a lot to even want to wash dishes in a very mindful, present way because of the tremendous momentum of the mind to always be doing something different. The grass is greener somewhere else. But to learn to train oneself and let go and relax and just be there for one thing, it's very, very helpful. There have been times in my life where I've been really busy, where I have a lot of good things going on, and I feel like I don't have enough time to do it all. And then there's times when I've had that feeling, where I really feel like kind of agitated, but I can't do it all. And what I'll do is I'll meditate. And logically, that's crazy, because meditation is not very productive. You're not getting any of my to-do list done. But invariably, I find that after I meditate, I seem to be so much more productive, or time has slowed down. I seem to be able to take care of the things that I want to do. And there's something about time and the busy mind, the agitated mind, that kind of skews this whole stuff. And so sometimes just meditating can make a difference. Some people will take driving as a mindful time. Not to drive, slowly, but to really drive mindfully aware. Turn off the radio, turn off the Bluetooth, I have both hands on the steering wheel, and just kind of stay present as full as you can driving. And if the mind wanders off and thinks about something else, come back and just drive and be present. So I know people who have parked when they go to work, parked in as far away as they think they can, it's reasonable in the parking lot, and then use that time to do walking meditation as they walk to work. So to kind of get themselves grounded and centered and present. I've known people who have made a custom of going to the bathroom more often than they really have to in terms of the biological needs. And because the bathroom, most people allow you to go to the bathroom. Excuse me, I need to go to the bathroom. People don't ask, what are you going to do in the bathroom? most people don't ask, right? So I need to go to the bathroom. And what you do is, the reason you need to go to the bathroom is you need to meditate. So you go sit in the toilet for a few minutes and just kind of just breathe and be present, check in and relax and make that a little, 2-minute mindfulness period or 5-minute mindfulness period. Most people will leave you alone in the stalls. And so it could be very nice. So I've known people have done that as a way to kind of touchstones through the day. So there's a lot of creative ways and fun ways to kind of bring more mindfulness to daily life. And I found a tremendous value in it. I know a lot of people have found value in it. What a wonderful thing that happens is that there's a synergy or a mutuality between meditation practice and mindfulness in daily life. As we become more mindful in daily life, the mind spins around less and less, less agitated, and then it becomes easier to meditate. Meditating, it becomes more satisfying. As meditation becomes a bigger part of his life, it's natural that spills over into daily life, the more presence. So they go back and forth and support each other over time. It's very nice. So that's one whole way that you can continue. If you're interested in this mindfulness stuff beyond meditation, one way you can develop it and support it, the growth of it, is to start bringing more mindfulness into your daily life and be playful with it, kind of have fun with it and enjoy it. The other whole way to go further in this kind of practice is to do more of the meditation. And one of the primary ways to do more is to, usually for most people, is to go to events. Some people can have the discipline to do it alone, meditate alone more, like spend a day in meditation or many hours a day. But it's strongly advised that if you're going to spend more than your, you know, an hour or 40 minutes, 20 minutes a day meditating on your own, it's good to do longer periods of meditation together with other people. So like here at IMC, we do day-long retreats, and people will come here and meditate for the day. We have one here on the 10th of November. And what's nice about IMC is that you can come and go as you want. You can come for half the day, a quarter of the day. You can come for one sitting. You can come for as long as you want. It works for you, and then you can go. And then there's longer retreats that you can do. We have our own retreat center in Santa Cruz County that you can come to now, and there's other retreat centers around. You can do some places have weekend retreats, sometimes week-long retreats, longer retreats. And what happens when you start sitting a longer period of time, or the primary activity of the day, not like you're meditating every possible minute of the day, but you might be meditating, you know, you might do 9-10 sessions of meditation in the course of a day, and is a certain kind of momentum gets built up, a certain amount of concentration gets built up. And you kind of, as you, you know, if you let go a little bit in your 20-minute, 30-minute, 40-minute meditation at home, you can let go a little bit, and then you start your day, and to a great extent, whatever you let go of, you pick up again. And so, but if you let go a little bit on retreat, you go to the next sitting, and you can, like, you don't have to pick up something. You don't have to go, you know, shopping, you don't have to cook, you don't have to talk to your boss, you don't have a deadline to make. You can just let go and stay letting go. And the deeper and deeper experiences of peace, of well-being, of letting go can occur. And also greater and greater self-understanding can happen. As we stay in silent meditation throughout much of the day, there's something about the silence and this regularity and the continuity of it that we begin seeing how the mind operates in greater and greater clarity. We start seeing the comparative thinking and what goes on in a way that's very hard in daily life. So there's a tremendous growth in wisdom and self-understanding on these things as well. So one of the ways of continuing with mindfulness meditation is to do these meditation retreats. And in our tradition, we are, we're kind of like a really big part of our kind of the background of where we come from is meditation retreats. It's kind of like the wellspring out of which this practice arose and came. So those are things you can think about. So we have about 10 minutes. Do you have any questions of anything that that you'd like to ask as we come towards the end here?
So when you're talking about comparative experiences and labeling. And so I'd want more information about the practice of labeling what's pleasant and unpleasant, because I've done that a little bit, and I've noticed in doing it spontaneously what I believed or thought was pleasant or unpleasant really wasn't. And it wasn't like I was analyzing it. It was like, that's not true. And so labeling pleasant or unpleasant just a story? Or is it just depend?
So I didn't talk about this during this course, I don't think. But one of the areas of our life that our tradition we emphasize is useful to pay attention to is the way in which what's called sometimes the common denominator of all experiences. All experiences have one of three common denominators or common elements that's everything. All experiences we have some quality of either pleasant in some way, unpleasant in some way, or neither pleasant nor unpleasant. There's no other option, right? And so, but it's a common denominator of all these things. And there's something about being able to clearly notice and see that it's pleasant that is very effective, because often what we react to and respond to is whether things are pleasant or unpleasant. And we might think we have very complicated rationale or reason to like something or not like something, but sometimes it's a simple amoeba-like movement away towards and away from that's really operating. And so sometimes the clear recognition that this is pleasant or this is unpleasant or this is neither pleasant nor unpleasant can free us from being kind of caught in the experience. So as we start noticing the pleasant and unpleasantness of our experience, then we start noticing eventually some very interesting things. And one of them is that sometimes things are pleasant and unpleasant not because how they are in and of themselves and the suchness of them, but rather because of what the mind says about them. So, you might have an association with someone. You had this really gnarly, mean teacher in second grade that, you're traumatized by and you still remember. And then you run into someone who kind of looks like that person, same color hair, same glasses, same height, same kind of dress, or whatever was going on. And, this is an unpleasant person. There's nothing unpleasant in that person inherently, but the association we bring to it, or the stories we make, we have people are of the other political party. This is unpleasant. Boy, is this unpleasant, this person, because, they don't have the same beliefs as you do. So it's possible to start seeing that pleasant and unpleasant, the way we are layers of it. And some of it is evaluative, some belong to the layers of the mind, and some are more primary, the experience in and of itself. And seeing that brings a lot of wisdom and it can help us not be so caught in things. Is that adequate as an answer? Okay. Someone else? Is there someone else? Yeah, but no one else? So, a few things then to say to end. It can be helpful if you're interested in meditation as a regular thing to meditate with other people to get some support. Sometimes it's hard to continue doing it on your own, and you're always welcome to come to IMC. When we have programs here, the door's open. As you know, I think you know now, we don't charge for anything. And it's pretty easy to just wander in and come in and participate. Very little or almost nothing's asked of you. We ask you to turn off your cell phones. That would be nice before meditation. But some people will feel that it's very, very nice to come here because it's one of the few places you can come kind of in a public scene and nothing's asked of you. It's kind of simple and easy. Some people feel a little bit uncomfortable because there's no one to greet you and who are these people, and you're kind of left alone, and so it's sort of these silent people, and they must be unfriendly. But usually people here are friendly, and just kind of the way we're set up is just to make it easy to come in. There's no one to pay at the door and welcome you in. It's just, please come. So there's we have a rich program of activities here, many days of the week. Our newsletter has a schedule, and please feel free to come back for any of it if it's supportive of you. And it's by design, we're somewhat casual about things here, so with the idea that makes it easy for people living busy urban lives to come and go as they need to. People, the kids need to go to sleep, and so you can't come at 7:30, so you come at 7:45 or come when you can. Had to stay late for work, and so just come when you can. So it's kind of, it was meant that way. We don't have membership here, but I like to say that if you like to be a member, you are. Just because, you know, membership means that we have to do a lot of work. We have to keep membership roles, and, you know, we like to keep things really simple here. There are other places you can meditate, groups you can sit with. In Mountain View, there's a South Bay Meditation, Insight Meditation South Bay, with Shyla Catherine leads that on Tuesday evenings. In San Jose, there's Birgit Jelaine has a sitting group on Wednesday evenings, and there's a variety of sitting groups around. There's local Zen Center groups that and other Buddhist groups you can go meditate with, and on Sunday mornings you can go sit with the Quakers. They let you, it's nice to go sit with them. They let you sit in silence mostly. And but it's nice to sometimes sit with other people because it's encouraging and supportive to know other people are doing this as well. I've known a few people who find that their values begin changing when they meditate, and so it's a little bit hard sometimes at work or with colleagues because you start being the odd person, the oddball, because you're the only one. You're the only one now who doesn't want to gossip, because it's hard. You know, it's hard to gossip if you've kind of have this sensitivity that comes from meditation. And so then you know you come here and there's other people who either you realize you're not so odd because other people like you, or you realize it's not so bad to be odd because there's so many other odd people. You know, as you wish. Whichever way you want to hold the flower, right? Odd, not odd. Neither odd or not odd, whatever. We also have retreats you can do. There's a meditation center. We have our own retreat center. There's a meditation center that's connected to us. It's called Spirit Rock in Marin County that has wonderful retreats and great teachers up there. So there's a lot you can do. And then for the next three Wednesdays, Shin Kwan, who's sitting in all the way in the back, because I asked her to stay with the candy, and which you could welcome to take as you leave, and Jim Podolsky here are going to lead what's called a beginner's practice group. And that's kind of meant for some of you, if you'd like, to get ongoing support for the next 3 weeks for meditation practice. They'll do a little bit of teaching. They'll answer questions. They'll do some meditation with you. And it's a wonderful way to continue and deepen what you're doing, get some support for it. They'll be available to answer a lot of your questions if you have. And both of them have done a lot of meditation. They're very experienced and wise people. And you're lucky to, you know, to have a chance to spend time with them. So that's the next three Wednesdays at the same time, 7:30 to 9. So I think that's enough. And anything that I should say that I left out? So thank you all for coming, and I hope that this was meaningful for you. And I know it's certainly been meaningful for me, this practice, and it's nice to be able to share it with you. So thank you.